National Independent Current Affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Jordan Curtis in Adelaide, coming up today on The Wire.
Satellite schooling by elite schools for Aboriginal children will not fix Aboriginal education.
Calls for the government to take a different approach to Indigenous education and...
NORTHWAS itself is quite open about it being an experiment. Our colleagues in Papua New Guinea and in the Pacific for years have been saying they don't want to be guinea pigs.
A radical new mining project in Papua New Guinea putting locals on edge. Also on The Wire, why is Yemen facing what's being called the world's worst hunger crisis? And a campaign to raise the oldest voices in the LGBTIQ community. To hear these stories and more on The Wire. But first, Tom Johnston from the newsroom is here to tell us what's making news. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Jordan.
So after much disunity in the conservative ranks in Australia, Family First has disappeared overnight.
That's right. Corey Bernardi's newly formed Australian Conservatives has announced it will merge with Family First, with the two Family First representatives and its existing resources to be transferred to Australian Conservatives. Though Family First founder Pastor Andrew Evans supports the merger, newly elected Senator Lucy Gachui isn't so keen on the shift and is likely to become an independent until the next election. Ben Eltham is the National Affairs Correspondent with New Matilda. Here's what he had to say on the developments.
Whether it is the beginning of a genuine right-wing minor party, I sort of think probably not, because it's still a very crowded marketplace. You know, and I think also the jury's out about whether Australia genuinely has an electorate that's interested in movement conservatives and, you know, like in hard right issues per se. Whether that can expand into like the right wing of the Liberal Party vote, you know, I don't know about it. I don't know if it can.
And still in Australian politics, we're still not sure what led up to the shooting incident on Manus Island.
Yeah, it's a real case of who done it and who do you believe? On Good Friday, open gunfire was reported at the Australian Run Detention Centre, but what led up to it is still in dispute. Where Peter Dutton says the cause of the shots fired into the detention centre was over concerns for the welfare of a five-year-old boy, PNG police say the boy was 10 and there was no official complaints by his parents. While this brings to light genuine concern over who to trust, Greens Senator Nick McKim isn't all that surprised by Dutton's claims and says the safety of those on the island is his chief concern.
Well, you've got to ask where Peter Dutton's getting his information from. Ultimately here, this is redolent of Children Overboard, where the Liberals have plenty of exposed form lying about refugees and people seeking asylum in Australia. It's abundantly clear that neither detainees nor staff at the detention centre on Manus Island are safe, or that they are detained or work in a safe place.
And in international news?
Well, Malcolm Turnbull will have his first face-to-face meeting with US President Donald Trump next week. We can only guess what they will be talking about at the meeting, but its location does give us some pointers. The meeting will take place aboard the USS Intrepid, a World War II aircraft carrier, which now serves as a museum on New York's Hudson River. As always, the meeting will seek to strengthen ties between the US and Australia.
Well, one thing I'm sure they'll discuss is the constant issues surrounding North Korea.
Yes, both leaders have very similar concerns. Actually, just yesterday, North Korea conducted a live-fire artillery drill marking the foundation of its military, which coincided with the arrival of a US submarine in South Korea. While the drill isn't out of character for North Korea, the show of force does speak to the ever-rising concern over their potential nuclear threat.
Thanks for joining us, Tom.
No props.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Now, the United Nations has warned that up to 18 million people in war-torn Yemen are at risk of famine if they do not receive urgent humanitarian aid. How exactly has the war exasperated the failed state's famine, and can it be moderated? The Wire's Michael McGarley reports.
A humanitarian catastrophe is unfolding in Yemen, the country situated at the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula. Since the country descended into civil war in 2015, over 7,600 people have been killed, with up to 42,000 people injured. The situation is escalating, however, and now around two-thirds of the state's population is facing a humanitarian crisis with an encroaching famine. To help us understand what exactly is exacerbating this crisis, Associate Political Lecturer from the University of Adelaide, David Olney, puts the situation into context with the causes of the civil war.
The origins of the conflict in Yemen are potentially centuries old, in that you've got two different communities believing in two different variants of Islam with different cultural and ethnic connections to different people in the region. It was exacerbated in the colonial period while under British rule, and after independence, it essentially meant that you've got huge competition for narrow amounts of resources.
The conflict is also a proxy war, with the two main players within Yemen both having support from opposing international forces.
So on one side, you've got the Houthis, who are not in power but have the support of a larger amount of population, supported by the Iranians, and on the other side, you've got the sort of rest of mainstream Yemen, supported by Saudi Arabia, who at the moment, you know, doing fairly devastating military operations. So the Houthis are being forced to respond, and as a consequence, no food is getting grown. No one can take anything to market. No one can safely get to market to buy anything. So the risk of a famine is just immense.
So what aspects of the situation are increasing the threat of famine?
There's a few things that need to sort of be unpacked to understand the famine. The first is, like a lot of the region, there have been some very bad droughts in the last 10 years. Yemen went through one round of drought prior to 2010 and are now going through another round of drought. And on top of that, people can't safely spend time working in their fields because of the violence. People are displaced within the country, so they're in unfamiliar spaces where they don't have access to land and resources. And then even if they can grow anything, they can't necessarily safely get to market to sell it, and people can't get to market to buy it. And I would imagine by this point, the regime are probably using food as a weapon. So if you're well-behaved, you will get some of the aid relief food coming in. If you're healthy and you fight back, you will be allowed to starve.
Have we seen a situation similar to this in the past where there has been a political answer, at least to moderate the issue?
In some ways, during the 1980s in Ethiopia, the famines were a bit like this in that they were a combination of drought and political problems and conflict between different groups in society. And really what had to happen in Ethiopia was just the world pouring food in no matter what, and then eventually the political problems got resolved. So in the short term, you just have to pour food in and then try and work out a political solution once people aren't starving to death.
What are the logistics involved in getting food to these people in such a widespread, complex, devastating conflict?
You literally have to talk to each significant group and say, what can we do to help distribute food in the areas you control? And accept that there's not at the moment a way to deal with Yemen as a whole. You really just have to try and put food in and hope that it isn't stolen by military forces or insurgent forces to feed combatants instead of feeding the population. So probably the only stipulation you could make is we'll give you the first couple of batches of food, but if we get evidence that you're hoarding it for combatants, we'll stop.
Associate Political Lecturer from the University of Adelaide, David Olney. Eric Journeau is the former head of mission in Yemen for Doctors Without Borders. I asked him what would be done if humanitarian aid missions struggle to access key logistical areas because of the conflict.
I'm not sure there is a plan B. My guess is that if the seaport of Hodeidah is damaged, then for sure the situation will deteriorate in Yemen for the civilians. Because the Yemeni population is dependent for almost 80% on food importation because the agriculture cannot allow them to produce enough for themselves. So they are completely depending on importation. There is the port of Aden, but for the moment that will not be sufficient to offload all the shipments, all the freight that would be needed for the entire country. That's why the port of Hodeidah has to be functional and spared by all worrying parties from this conflict.
Eric Journeau, the former head of mission in Yemen for Doctors Without Borders, ending that report by the Wire's Michael McGarley. Now, private schools are pushing for more individual Aboriginal campuses under a proposal presented to the federal government. The Association of Heads of Independent Schools of Australia is encouraging the idea, and if the schools are filled with only Indigenous Australian students, these separate schools will receive more taxpayer funding to establish them. However, not everyone supports the plan. The Wire's Catherine Andrews spoke with Indigenous educator, who says the funding plan is not fair towards students attending public schools.
The public school education has 83% of Aboriginal student enrolment, and the elite private school systems have only 10% of Aboriginal peoples. It's really important to invest where most Aboriginal kids are enrolled. They're enrolled at their local neighbourhood school, and robbing poor schools to pay elite schools to try and fix the problem when they only have as minimal as 10 to 5% of Indigenous enrolment isn't going to fix the problem. The second point is that there's no evidence that satellite schools work, that funded by the private sector and in terms of Aboriginal education tries to fix retention rates and attendance rates. It would be problematic and almost irresponsible to take from public schools funds to pay elite schools to develop satellite schools.
Do you think Indigenous-only private school campuses could be a feasible possibility at all?
The evidence is suggesting that we need more culturally responsive teachers and schooling to make a difference. Teachers, no matter where they are, whether they're in the private or the public school systems, we give them competence and confidence to enact the national curriculum. The national curriculum is so overcrowded that it needs a strong curriculum enactment process. And therefore, the evidence is suggesting that we invest in our teachers to enact our national curriculum the way that it was intended in order to make a difference.
Do you think schools like this could create segregation?
It's really interesting, this whole notion of segregation. Public schools are open to all, and they reject old-fashioned notions of exclusion, separateness, or individual privilege. Public schools where the majority of Aboriginal people are enrolled across Australia have this commitment to equality and equity. And so they are their local neighbouring schools for Aboriginal kids. To then try and take public funds away from those that are limited to a certain privileged type of student in the independent schools that have a religious background or persuasion really misses the point. The point is that public schools are open to all. They have the majority of Aboriginal students, and therefore robbing them to pay for an elite school type of program is not the way to go, and as I said, is irresponsible in its funding objection.
Do you think the government could be doing more to provide fairer education funding for Indigenous students in both public and private schools?
I think that what we've really missed is a real opportunity. These opportunities of funding redistribution of schooling only come along once in a lifetime. And the Gonski funding model was the ability to redistribute funding on the basis of need. That is a key aspect that the government should concentrate on, how to redistribute funding according to need. At the moment, schools aren't equal in terms of how you understand funding. So the elite schools aren't the same as those that are working in high poverty areas. The schooling funding inequality that's happening is vast, it's real, and unless we address it, Aboriginal education movement for better educational outcomes won't be achieved overnight.
Professor Lester Iribina-Rigney from the University of South Australia speaking with The Wire's Catherine Andrews. On Monday, on The Wire, we heard about the outcome of the first round of the French elections, with centrist Emmanuel Macron taking the top spot, followed closely by far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. Former Wire journalist Stephanie Richards has been living in France in the lead-up to the election. I caught up with her to see how the result is affecting the mood on the ground.
A bit disheartened, a bit worried. There are a lot of people who might not vote. She might abstain from voting just because they don't agree with either of the two candidates. And then there's a lot of people as well who are saying, well, you know, you have to vote for Macron because otherwise we've got Marine Le Pen as well in the other corner. So they're voting for Macron against Marine Le Pen, not because they support Macron.
So how much support have you been hearing for Macron?
Not too much. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of former presidents and some of the other candidates have come out and said that, no, you should support Macron. So we're expecting a lot of voters for the other candidates, for example, Fillon and Amon and all of them, to turn their votes now to Macron. It's interesting because Macron is quite a young candidate, his youngest ever presidential candidate being 39. So for me, I thought that a lot of younger French people would vote for him in thinking that he's a young person, he will prioritise young people in his voting. But in actual fact, a lot of people, and I can use a quote from a French person who said to me, he's young but he's old in his head, in that a lot of his policies don't support young people. So it's interesting. I think ultimately Macron will become the president, and a lot of French people were 100% sure that he will become the president. But whether or not he becomes the president because people like him, I'm not sure.
Have you noticed any increase in security forces or police presence over the election period?
Not necessarily over the election period, but since I've been in France, since September, definitely been hyped up security, and a lot more than what I've seen from previous times I've been in France. You can go anywhere, not even just in the major tourist sites, but just in a small town, and there's police and fully armoured army personnel who are patrolling the streets. So there's definitely this atmosphere of a bit of fear everywhere, really. But it's definitely more hyped up. A lot of people are more alert. And I think that the recent terrorist attack, which was last week, definitely helped Le Pen in her support in the recent election. There's been quite a few terrorist attacks recently, and I think that that's really bolstered her support.
Has there been any notable moments in the election campaign so far?
There was recently a big debate with all 11 candidates, and that was the first debate of that kind in France. So basically each 11 candidates got together for a televised debate where they spoke for 4 hours, I think it went in the end, about their policies. And that was quite good for democracy, I thought, from my perspective, because really there were four main candidates and then the rest of them were kind of minor ones. And so it was good to hear the minor candidates put forward their policies and their ideas and really get their voice, because they kind of got a bit lost in the election as well.
Journalist Stephanie Richards talking to The Wire from France. The second round of the French presidential election will be held on the 7th of May. Now, the movement for the LGBTIQ community and their fight for equal rights in a dominantly hetero society has been a prominent fought war. Yet within this community, there is a forgotten generation, the older members. They are being encouraged to raise their voices in South Australia with a new initiative from the Council of the Aging and the SA Rainbow Advocacy Alliance. Project manager Desmond Ford told The Wire's Lauren Connolly about the
LGBTIQ People Aging Well project.
So I guess sort of three key things in the project. One is to provide an opportunity for older LGBTIQ people across the state to have their voice heard in terms of what's important to them, what are their hopes, what are their aspirations, maybe what are some of their concerns as well. Part of that builds on some work that's been done previously through a forum that was held late in 2015. Following on from that, it's about building a group that can help in work going forward, and also the Rainbow Advocacy Alliance in terms of where they might need to be putting some energy and effort. Most importantly, it's about celebrating and acknowledging older LGBTIQ people. I think we sort of live in a world where older people generally are often made quite invisible, and I think that applies sort of within the LGBTIQ community as well.
Why is it important that the older LGBTIQ community are recognised?
The reason that we've got to this sort of point in time where a project like this can get up, where we've got conversations about marriage equality, is because of certainly the sort of activism that older LGBTQI people, not just here in South Australia, but if you look at sort of across the country, particularly in the 1970s, the kind of activism that took place then. You know, if there's someone in their sort of 60s, 70s, likely to have covered the period where their relationships were deemed unlawful and where maybe sort of came out during the gay liberation movement. So they've got really important things to say and done amazing things in terms of working out how they manage their relationships, how they create their own sort of sense of family, that sort of thing.
Why is it just now that people are being made aware of the types of discrimination the LGBTIQ community face?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. Why just now? I mean, I think there's been some work being done nationally. Sort of in the last 4 or 5 years, things have really sort of got more public kind of attention. I think recognising the different groups that require, sort of maybe have the same kind of hopes and needs as older people generally, but recognising the uniqueness and the differences for older LGBTI people. But I guess because there needed to be, because there was, you know, before that there was nothing.
How can the experiences of the older LGBTIQ community and the development of the People Ageing Well Project help today's younger LGBTIQ generation?
I guess the short answer is I'm not really sure. It's one of the things that I'm really interested in terms of something that we could do, is provide that opportunity for people. I think there's real value, I don't want to tell young people what to think, but I think there's real value in knowing how we got to this point in time, and sort of knowing that, I guess, and understanding what it was like back then. I think it's a two-way thing, personally. I think it's what could we learn from each other? What can young people teach older people? What can older people teach young people? But certainly that sort of understanding our history, the fact that we can be more confident about being out as a gay person these days compared to someone who maybe lived a very secret and very closeted life, because they might face discrimination, they might face persecution, all of those kind of things. So I sort of see it as a two-way street in terms of learning for both older and younger people.
Desmond Ford of the LGBTIQ People Ageing Well Project, speaking with The Wire's Lauren Connolly. The Bismarck Sea in Papua New Guinea is home to a number of small islands, diverse marine life and a strong fishing culture. But could this all be at risk? Canadian mining company Nautilus Minerals is trying to embark on a world first, mining the seabed for rare and valuable minerals. With the full effects of this project yet to be seen and strong opposition from the locals, just how safe is it? I spoke with Dr. Helen Rosenbaum of the Deep Sea Mining Campaign, who explained the uncertain history of this operation.
The project is scheduled to actually begin in 2019. I think it was first scheduled to start in about 2010. The technology just isn't really there yet, and the finance isn't there yet, because financiers, banks and other, you know, normal funding institutions are very wary of this high-risk project. Nautilus itself is quite open in its documentation that it has to lodge with the Canadian Securities Commission about the high-risk nature of this project, and the fact is that they're quite open about it being an experiment. Our colleagues in Papua New Guinea and in the Pacific for years have been saying they don't want to be guinea pigs in Nautilus's experimental seabed mining. The economic benefits, the returns from Solwara 1 are really uncertain, even by Nautilus's own admission. And the impacts of this project are totally unknown, both on the seabed itself and for the food chain and broader marine ecosystems.
So you said it is a risky project. What are the main risks you're concerned about?
Well, the main risks we're concerned about are the environmental risks, which then feed into the social and health risks, if you like, for the local fishing communities. So at the site, the hydrothermal vents are 1.6 kilometres under the surface of the water, spouting out plumes of this black sulfuric smoke and ash, which contains minerals. And the minerals, over thousands of years, these have been spouting this out. The minerals have built up metres and metres high, and it's that sulfidic mineral complex that the mining company is after. It's a really unique environment, and very weird and wonderful exotic creatures live down there which aren't found anywhere else on the planet. And it's even thought that each hydrothermal vent system, each area of hydrothermal vents, has its own endemic marine fauna, so that another hydrothermal vent doesn't even have the same set of marine fauna and species as each other. So they're quite unique ecosystems, and very little is known about them. It's very expensive to research down there. Very little science is done down there, except that science which is funded by these companies. So it is quite difficult to get independent scientific information about the ecosystems down there, and also about the likely impacts of seabed mining.
Should there be greater restrictions on international mining companies and where they can dig?
Deep sea mining is a totally unregulated activity. There isn't a deep sea mine actually in operation yet. This Nautilus Solar One mine in Papua New Guinea will be the first mine to operate, and all the eyes of the world who are interested in tearing up the ocean floor for money are watching to see how this mine proceeds in Papua New Guinea before they plunge into it themselves.
Dr. Helen Rosenbaum, coordinator of the Deep Sea Mining Campaign. And that's all for The Wire today. Today's show came from the studios of Radio Adelaide. I'm Jordan Curtis. Thanks for tuning in.
An opportunity of a lifetime to enhance your skills overseas and expand your global networks awaits you. The Australian Government's Australia Awards, Endeavour Scholarships and Fellowships provides financial support for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to undertake study, professional development or research overseas towards an Australian Master's, PhD or postdoctoral research in any field. Further your studies around the world and improve the outcomes for future generations of Indigenous Australians. For more information, see the Endeavour Scholarships and Fellowships website.
2SER sponsors.